Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today a man who really needs very little introduction, former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Texas, Tom Phillips. Judge, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
We've had the privilege, Judge, of having some former Supreme Court justice, and actually Justice Jeff Boyd, current Supreme Court justice, was our very first guest on the show. But we're super happy to have you with us and look forward to our visit today. I know I said that you need no introduction, but just to kind of set the stage.
For some of your younger viewers.
Let's talk a little bit about your background and your early career, and then we'll kind of launch into the rest.
Well, I'm a native of Dallas, went to Baylor and to Harvard Law School, and clerked for the Supreme Court of Texas, one of four justices who started their career there as a law clerk. Then I worked for Baker Botts in Houston, the only office they had then, and was appointed by Governor Clements as a district judge in 1981 when I was 31 years old. Still probably the most exciting day of my life. Was elected twice with, as Judge Stovall back in Houston would say, plenty of opposition, but no opponent. Then in late 1987, when Chief Justice Hill announced his resignation, Governor Clements, back in office after a term out in the wilderness, appointed me as chief. And I served in 1988 and then was elected in the fall of that year and was reelected in 1996 and 2002. I left the court in 2004 and purified myself with a year of teaching at South Texas and SMU law schools. And since 2005, I've been in the Austin office of Baker Botts.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge. I didn't recall that you took that, what we might call now a gap year, in between your time at the Supreme Court and Baker Botts. So how was that experience with teaching at the two law schools?
It was probably the hardest thing I've ever done. I mean, just trying to prepare four or five courses. And it was just when the internet was becoming ubiquitous and the students would all carry their computers into class with them and they would look up a case, as you were talking about, they'd look up a commentary and say, well, Professor Joe Blow says this, and what do you say about that? And so they kept me on my toes, and then they'd send emails at 10 or 11 at night. Well, we've been sitting around, we think what you said today was wrong. So what do you have to say about that? And I was happy to retreat to a place where at least there was some delay in the critique of your work.
I hadn't considered that as being a risk. There were laptops in the classroom when I was in law school, very few, but they were there. But it was before the age of wireless internet. So,
well, I think I didn't have the proper discipline on.
We had wireless, but I'm pretty sure I never emailed a professor to tell them they were wrong. I don't think that happened while I was in law school.
Much less a former Chief Justice of Texas.
Right.
These were discussion groups, and maybe I should have stuck with a pure lecture, the great man dropping pearls of wisdom, but that just wasn't the kind of classes we were running by and large.
This is the risk of inviting discourse in the classroom, I suppose. Well, if you're educated in Texas, you know, there's certainly an abundance of jurisprudence out of the Texas Supreme Court that has your name on it at the top of the masthead. You presided over the court at a very interesting time in its history, I would say, at a time when it was still possible for people of both parties to be elected to the court. In fact, I think this is still correct to say that my judge, Raul Gonzalez, I know he was the last Democrat elected to the court, and I think he may be the last Democrat elected to statewide office. I'm not 100% sure on that.
He tied. There were several people elected in the 1994 election, including John Sharp and Bob Bullock, several others. And Raul was in that group, although unlike them, he was unopposed. So he had an easier race in 94. People who were not particularly enamored of Judge Gonzalez found a person willing to run as a Republican named George Bush. And so the organized bar drafted Judge Kitzman into the Republican primary on the pledge that if he was the nominee, he would withdraw from the race. And he was the nominee by a fairly narrow margin over Mr. Bush. Then he lived up to his promise and withdrew. That was the year that Judge Gonzalez had still the most expensive judicial race in the history of Texas in his primary, where he defeated Renee Haas in a runoff that was such an exemplar of how judicial races could go wrong that it caused Governor Bullock to convene a special committee and come up with a new plan. And really, that generated about a decade worth of interest in judicial selection reform. I said interest, not actual changes.
Not motion.
Oh, right. Well, we're going to cover that topic in some depth here before too long. But when you said he had run unopposed, I was going to challenge you because that was exactly the time that I was interviewing with Judge Gonzalez during the time he was going through that hotly contested primary. And I wasn't sure I was going to have a job or not, but he did prevail in the primary and the rest is history.
You were hired by the entire court, technically, for just that reason, because we would come in and say, we have, or we're going to extend an offer to this young law student. Is there any objection? And while I was there, there never was. But just prior to my coming, there had been some objection. But that policy was introduced when we went to the individual hiring, just for that reason, that tenure is always an uncertain thing on an elected court.
Well, that was good to know that there was that sort of safety net. I'm not sure I was aware of that at the time. But certainly Judge Gonzalez was a very animated figure on the court. But over that same period of time, there were so many other interesting figures. We had, two future attorneys general, a future governor. Before I got there, you had a future congressman, former Justice Doggett, now Congressman Doggett. So between Doggett and former Justice Cornyn, former Justice Abbott, let's see, you could almost make a case that the Supreme Court at that period of time was sort of a stepping stone to other offices.
Well, it was definitely that in the 19th century when a number of governors and senators went on, had a stint on the Supreme Court at some point in their career. The court became much less political through much of the 20th century when it really was the final job. Very few people left the court to do another job other than be a visiting judge or just sit around and whittle. There was no maximum age retirement until the late 60s or early 70s. So there were people serving on the court up into their 80s. And then it got somewhat more political, really starting with Will Wilson running for attorney general in 1956. And then I guess Justice Doggett was the next person to run from the court for another office. And after that race, we changed the rules of ethics to require a judge at any level to resign from the judiciary to run for a non-judicial office. I didn't regard this a particularly bold step because every other state with a judicial conduct code already had that provision, but we adopted it in Texas in time that when Judge Cornyn decided in 1995 to run for attorney general, he resigned. I think it wasn't the rule then, but it was going to be the rule, and he knew it was going to be passed about that time, so he left.
You also had, I guess, Justice Gambidge kind of did it in reverse.
Well, it was a stopping point for him because you may recall he ran for governor in 2002 and lost in the Democratic primary to Dan Morales, and Judge Specter ran for state representative the next cycle, I think, in a special election and lost to Joe Strauss, went on to become speaker. So we did have a few more political aspirants there, but they did not resign from the court to make a race.
Well, if the listeners can't tell, Chief Justice Phillips is a walking font of historical knowledge about the Texas Supreme Court specifically, but about politics also. Probably as good a time as any to bring up your impressive campaign button collection, which I've seen during my time at the court. Are you still doing that, or what are you doing with your buttons these days?
Well, they're in some boxes downstairs. My wife is a very tolerant person, but she didn't like my button display case, which took up most of her room, as much as you would think. Wanted to waste some wall space with family pictures and such. So I got rid of gave the display case to a museum, which had always been in my offices as long as I was a judge. And the buttons are now, they're less exposed to light, but they don't make them like they used to. So my collection pretty much ends in the 70s and 80s.
Ah, okay.
They're bigger now, not as easy to store.
I can only imagine. And you had quite a number of them, as I recall.
Alas, yes.
Well, we thought about having you on the show, not only because of your position as a former Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court, and now for many years having been in private practice as an appellate practitioner. So you've got that additional experience. But you mentioned judicial selection. And my recollection is that there's been a trend, I would say, in among the recent holders of your former office to being rather outspoken on the idea of how Texas selects its judges, and specifically its appellate judges. So it's fair to say that that remains your position, is, you know, that you are an advocate for reform in the judicial selection process. Is that fair to say?
That's fair.
Okay. And your successor, former Chief Justice Wallace Jefferson, you know, is known as having the same basic position. And I believe Chief Justice Hecht has spoken out on these issues too. At what point do you remember when you first started really thinking about there needing to be reform in the system, and what led you to be a proponent for it?
Well, in college government, of course, which goes back into the 1960s, the Texas government class that was required of everyone who was going to be a school teacher, and I wanted to take it. There, we had an exchange of views written by Judge Calvert and Judge W.A. Morrison on the Court of Criminal Appeals. So that's the first time I was aware of the issue. Calvert told the story of when he was campaigning, and somebody said, "I'm so glad to meet an actual Supreme Court justice, because heretofore I've always just voted for the second name on the ballot to counteract the uninformed vote." And Morrison argued that he went over to see a law school classmate who was now a federal judge, and he had to go through administrative assistant after assistant, one of whom finally called into the judge and said, "There's a man here who claims he's a judge and claims he knows you." And he said his door as a judge, since he was elected, would always be open. So those were the two kind of competing views. But I got more interested when Don Yarbrough, a 35-year-old lawyer from Houston who eventually had a little murder for hire problem and bribery problem and went to prison, was elected to the Supreme Court of Texas by a rather handsome margin over Chief Justice Charlie Barrow of the San Antonio Court of Appeals. That got me exercised, but not actually personally involved. So alas, like so many, I got personally involved when I was appointed in 1981 to a state district bench in Harris County and faced election in 1982 in a county that generally voted Democratic, and I had been appointed by a Republican governor. So that's when I got excited about it. And Wayne Fisher, then the president of the state bar, put me on a bar committee to study reform. And I testified in front of the legislature with some regularity prior to being appointed chief justice. And And one of the reasons Governor Clements appointed me is I already had a good record on this. He thought the way Texas judges were selected was lamentable, particularly since so many of his appointees have been defeated, I suspect. But also as a litigator, as a person who had litigated in the court in connection with his business career. So my record on that, I think, was key to my being appointed. The Republican Party at that time had generally been on the record for changing the way judges are selected, because it's generally the party who's losing in Texas that is the most perceptive about the fact that we are at a competitive disadvantage with other states and recruiting new businesses and all because of judicial selection. And we don't serve the public very well by having these massive partisan sweeps that defeat dozens or hundreds of judges at a time. So it was not unpopular, was not a politically courageous thing when I served to be for judicial selection reform. But it was a politically difficult thing to accomplish, as seen by the fact that Governor Koch in 1875 said, go ahead and vote for the new Constitution, people of Texas, and I'll get that lamentable judicial selection clause changed. But he didn't. He got elected to the U.S. Senate and left, and here we are.
Well, I think we need to unpack that just a little bit. So our system of judicial selection is constitutional, dating back to the pre-1875.
The voters adopted it for the first time in 1849. We were the last state to join the union with an appointed judiciary until Alaska. So we came into the tail end, and the very next year started a real national sweep towards elected judges. And the reasons why are still being debated among the scholars who are interested in such things. So we had elected judges from 1849 to 1866, then appointed, basically. And now we've had elected ever since. But they were not partisan initially. I mean, they could have been, but the parties were not as, they kind of, by agreement, stayed out of the judicial races early. And then in the lead up to the Civil War, some of the races started becoming a test for more openly partisan races. And here we've been ever since.
Wow. I didn't realize it had gone back just that far.
Oh, well, the judicial races ordinarily are pretty quiet, kind of like watching toast. But when there are political passions and nothing better to spend them on, the main thing I can think of was prohibition, where the press kind of forced every candidate, you know, either wet or dry, regardless of whether your job was going to actually deal with that or not. And so Texas had some turnover because of the prohibition issue. Then there was a bit of this on labor issues in the 1950s. I mean, you were in the 50s, you were either for right to work or against it, and that spilled over to the judicial races. And then, of course, I guess abortion has been the big one of my career, where a lot of people want to know how you stand on an issue solely governed by United States Supreme Court rulings if you're going to be a trial court judge in their state.
And the canons really put judges in a weird position on that kind of stuff too, which makes it even more difficult for a political campaign.
Well, it may be more difficult. I think most judges welcome the canon because the judicial function is different from a legislative function, and your personal feelings should be irrelevant. And some of the most hard-nosed judges I've known in terms of just enforcing the law and telling people to get out of the court are themselves Teddy Kennedy-type liberals who, if they were in the legislature, would be voting for a very different scheme. But they're not. They're judges, and they apply the law. And probably vice versa. Some very conservative people on the bench will apply the law in a way that they would not vote for if they were in the legislature. But one thing that's happened in my career is so many of the decisions, the basic guiding legal decisions that used to be governed by common law, have been codified. And you see that particularly in the tort area, where we had two or three statutes like contribute to comparative negligence in 19. I tried maybe the last contrib case in the state of Texas in 1981. But we've had comparative negligence since 1973. There were a few statutes, contribution, things like that. But by and large, all the rules were made by judges. And now, by and large, they're all made by the legislature. And the judges only have a few policy decisions to make.
Well, when we had Justice Green on his main stance when it came to judicial selection reform was needing to take the money out of politics, needing to take the money out of judicial races is probably a better way to say it, just because in his view, I believe he described it as something like, it just seems unseemly and people tend to think that they're entitled to something if they contribute a lot of money to a particular candidate's campaign. And he told a kind of a chilling story about how someone that he knew and had been friends with tried to leverage that relationship into insider information coming out of the Texas Supreme Court, and how that it really ruined the relationship. So I assume you agree that the money is really the big problem here and that there's probably a lot more to it, but be interested to hear sort of what your overall philosophy is on the need for change.
Well, certainly while I was in office, I was very worried about the money. And Justice Hecht and I and several other candidates of both parties in Judge Hightower in 1988, Judge Doggett, for that matter, and Judge Cook, we imposed a voluntary cap because we were very concerned about large dollars in the Supreme Court race. And the person I was running against had taken $120,000 from an oil man who had a case pending in the court at the time of the contribution and voted differently on rehearing than on the original case. And of course, I served with that judge. I don't believe the contribution affected his decision. And I never alleged that it did, but we sure ran a lot of ads saying it looked bad, and it did look bad. So the legislature put in the caps that are voluntary, but most people outside of South Texas abide by those, you know, sign up and abide by those caps. And that solves some of the money problem. I think it's entirely different constellation of facts than it was when I was running, because when I was running, most people still got their news from a local source. There was a lot of ticket splitting. Only in a real sweep year did people think, well, I'll send a message to Walter Mondale or I'll teach Bill Clinton a lesson and vote the straight ticket the other way. There was a lot of ticket splitting in judicial races, and newspaper endorsements, even bar endorsements, made a difference. The candidate endorsed by the who won the most votes in the Houston bar poll generally won a down ballot race. And now there's no positive effect from that. There's probably a few curmudgeons who vote against all the lawyer backed candidates, and that's it. So in one sense, there's less need for money now than there was when I was running, probably. But in another sense, there's more need. I mean, if you are going to make any impact at all on the election, you got to get your message out in a campaign environment that in the urban areas includes dozens or hundreds of other candidates. And that's almost impossible to do. I've never thought an anonymous judicial race, like let's just say you sign up and nobody spends any money and we'll see what happens, is a service to the public either at all. It does seem to me that the qualifications being rather minimal, like the first time you need to have seen the courthouse is when you go in to take the oath, is a huge problem. The party sweeps are a huge problem. And the perception of money as opposed to the reality is a huge problem. I never, frankly, had any problem with a lawyer in my 23 years on the bench, thinking that giving to me entitled them to something or that they were likely to get something. I did have problems with non-lawyers who kind of, I mean, particularly, well, people who were not used to judicial candidates running, like from out of state, who would assume that a contribution gave you an entree to make a phone call or write a letter. And you just had to explain to them or send them a copy of the code or something. It didn't work that way. They were only contributing to have, you know, a judge who would listen to their argument and listen to the other side's argument. Those people didn't tend to give again.
I'm going to ask, because I know the answer to this question off the top of your head, but what year was it that 60 Minutes profile came out that really stirred things up?
December 6, 1987, 7 p.m. Eastern time. And they had filmed that in the fall of 1987. Largely at the behest, I think, of the Texaco Public Relations Department, because it came down in the wake of the Supreme Court declining to hear the appeal from the huge verdict for Pennzoil in Harris County in what was at the time the largest civil judgment ever. It's still a very famous case. At any rate, They were filming it at the judicial section meeting that was in Corpus Christi. And Joe Jamail was being filmed a lot. And he kept trying to get me to come over and say hi to him. And could not understand why I didn't want to say hello. And the people who went over there and got the big bear hug from him were, you know, were on national TV with the intimation. He was the only lawyer there, and he was there to buy judges. Now, he was there as part of the Texas Bar Foundation. You know, maybe 40 lawyers were there. Nothing in the 60-minute show was incorrect, but it was powerfully put together. I'll just say that. And it's still on YouTube, and younger generation of lawyers should certainly look at it. And I bought a copy of it, $50 or $100 or something. And we showed it, for instance, at the Republican State Convention. We piped it through the hotel on one of their channels 24 hours a day. And we used excerpts from it in our campaign ads. And 60 Minutes, I'm sure, was highly upset about that. But they sent us a letter the Friday before the election or the Saturday before the Tuesday election asking us to cease and desist with the use because it was a copyright violation. And we've been using it for almost a year.
Wow. The title of that was Justice for Sale. Am I remembering that right?
Justice for Sale, question mark, is Mike Wallace. And it was a pretty hard-hitting piece. And it was about the fact that there were huge sums of money being given by a handful of people. My opponent, for instance, had raised $2 million, and over $1 million of it was from 50 donors. And about 15 of those donors had a $1 million independent contribution that was to elect somebody to the state senate in Bear County and other candidates. And the other candidates, which was 99% of the money, was Supreme Court candidates. And they had ads showing somebody who was supposed to be me taking bags of money. And they were nasty ads. And a lot of the people who are for strict campaign contribution limits don't realize that there's a First Amendment right of speech for independent expenditures for whatever you want to say. And those are not subject to any code of judicial conduct or any other screening. And when Texas gets to be a genuine two-party state again at the statewide level, you'll see those kind of ads because they, in Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania and Illinois and Mississippi, they blight the air with extremely unfair allegations that you can't hold the candidate responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they're so blatant, they backfire against the person they intend to help. As former Chief Justice Prather of Mississippi, who had the U.S. Chamber of Commerce come in and do such a trash job on her opponent, which she didn't want this to happen, and it backfired and she got beat.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
Well, it's certainly a complex issue. I mean, it's not just about the money, as you point out. I mean, you mentioned wanting to make sure there's a qualified judiciary coming to the bench, dealing with the negative impacts of party sweeps. We've certainly seen that in the last couple of cycles here in Texas. But
of course, we didn't have any Republican judges till Clements became governor. So that made it easy.
Everything was a party sweep.
Yeah.
There were 35 races in Harris County for district judge. I remember this well. And 30 of them were won by the Democrats, and most had a Republican incumbent. I mean, starting in 1982, there have been periodic sweeps, and they went back and forth in the 80s and 90s. And then for about 10 years, it was only Republican, starting in 94, which was a massive Republican sweep. And Republicans knocked off most of the rest of the Democratic judges outside of, in the large areas outside of South Texas for the next 10 or 12 years. And then since then, more often been Democratic sweeps than not.
Well, you hear different models thrown around as possible alternatives to the current system. And I know that you are very well versed in these different models and we're happy to talk about those. I just wanted to point out one thing that came to mind. I mentioned the interview with Justice Green earlier. We also had Justice Gina Benavides on the show, and the subject of judicial selection happened to come up with her too. And she felt actually very strongly I wouldn't say it's quite the opposite on all fours, but you know, her view of it is to take away the power of the voter in selecting judges very likely would tend to disenfranchise the minority vote, is if I'm accurately rephrasing that, Jody.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so that was a perspective that I'm not sure I had really heard quite that way before. But so I'm happy to visit about that. But I think maybe this would be a good time to transition into the Texas Commission on Judicial Selection, which is something you've been very deeply involved in up to now. Tell us a little bit about the commission, how it got started, and what its role is.
I'll do that, but I do want to comment on Justice Benavides' perspective. There was a minor push for judicial selection reform in the last session of the legislature, a group called, it was a committee pushing merit selection. And they got a little traction, which ended up as things with a little bit of traction so often do in a study committee. Four appointed by the governor, four by the lieutenant governor, four by the speaker, one by the chief justice, one by the presiding judge of the criminal court, and one by the state bar. And Hecht appointed Chief Justice Jefferson, and Presiding Judge Keller appointed me to this commission. So it met for a year, once a month, and then had a series of virtual hearings around the state to take testimony and wrote a report. The four appointees appointed by the lieutenant governor were pretty much for no change. They were all stand pat. The House was split. Most of the governor's appointees were for, and the judicial appointees, I say most, I guess all, were for a change in the system and probably a change to appoint initial appointment and then retention elections. And the bar appointee was for stand pat. So you add that up, it came up to pretty much a standoff. And the report said, well, the system's not working very well and it ought to be changed. And you all, the legislature, figure that out and let the people vote on it, because there was no particular recommendation for anything. They were against nonpartisan, and merit selection did not get a majority. It got a seven, that's an appointed retention election system, got a 7-7-1 tie. So it was a bit of a letdown experience, but I think everybody learned something, quite a bit about the pluses and minuses of each system. At my insistence, we wrote every chief justice and every court administrator in the nation to get their perspectives on their own system and how they could be better. But these weren't private documents, so I guess I should have known that. Almost all came back, our system is the best. A few judges in elected systems said we do need some better way to police the money. But pretty much everybody that was elected was happy with elected, appointed was happy with appointed. The polling data came out inconclusive. It's all how you ask the question. Would you like to vote on hundreds of people and you have no idea whether they're qualified or not and let them be a judge that can take away your life, liberty, and property? People would say no. If you want some pointy-headed people who think they're better than you to choose your judges for you, people were against that too.
It's all in how you ask the question.
It's always all in how you ask the question. But COVID had made this a bad session for any kind of complicated initiative, because by the time you plug the budget hole and do redistricting in 36 hours and take care of other emergencies that have arisen, this is not a good year for a new initiative in Texas, particularly something as complicated as a constitutional one. But I think some judge on our court, I would say Judge Garwood, but I'm not sure that's right, said there are plenty of ways to select judges and none of them are any damn good. And that's probably true, because we're asking the political system to come up with a non-political person at the same time has some political astuteness. So tough to do. Judge Enoch said about the wisest thing I've heard on the whole issue, which is you cannot take politics out of selecting judges. You can take politics out of deciding whether to keep a judge in office or not. And that's kind of become a touchstone to me. I mean, there's a lot of ways of electing a judge, and I think they need money to get that message out, because you want an informed voter. And there's ways of appointing judges, but those will be inevitably, there'll be a political dollop in there. Then the question is, how do you keep a judge who's doing a good job and not keep a judge who's doing a bad job. And I think the retention election, they're using close to half the states. While they probably judges do, there are some bad judges retained who probably shouldn't be. There are not too many good judges that lose a retention election. Occasionally, there's a single issue vote, and there are some bad judges who get voted out. More important, maybe even than that, is the effect on the judge. In the current system, as politicized as it's become, over half our judges still run for re-election with no opponent. And a sizable number of judges, particularly in smaller counties, were initially appointed and have never had an opponent. Well, that's sort of a Soviet-style election. And talking about the people's right to choose, the people have to have a lawyer who is willing to file for office more than 1 year before they would actually take that office and stand presumably against an incumbent judge who's the only judge they're going to appear in front of and make their living for more than a year. So many of our rural judges are not intimately familiar with the glories of a contested campaign. And it's true in an urban area. Once the judiciary becomes solidly ensconced in one party, and the judges who are elected by that party get along well with the local political leadership, they don't very often draw an opponent. The bar is not as well organized as it used to be. That's not saying anything too controversial. It's just true. I mean, even if a lot of lawyers don't like the judge, it's probably not going to be opposed. So I've always thought that the pitch to, well, the people need a right to decide, and you're taking away the people's right to decide, is, I don't know quite the right word, but it's a propaganda that's misleading, because in a retention election system, every judge is voted on. And most of those systems provide a mechanism of gathering data about the judge, about how many cases they actually try or how many opinions they write and how often they're reversed. And there's polls of lawyers, there's polls of jurors and witnesses, and all that's put up on a website. And you can decide if you think this judge ought to step down and let's throw this thing into the appointed process and see what happens. In other words, would you trust the world against the person you have or not? About 97% of the time, people go with the devil they know, but it is a process. And I think it has a good effect on an incumbent judge. I do worry about the diversity in 60s, 70s, 80s. Merit selection states had more diversity than elected states. That's not true anymore. But there are certainly ways around that. And one way is to do what several states, Illinois, Pennsylvania, New Mexico do, which is you have an initial open election, and then the judge stands for re-election in a yes-no retention system. I think those elections would be more meaningful, particularly if they were nonpartisan, because there's 200 people on the ballot, and you'd have to be a real nerd and probably an unemployed nerd to actually know the relative merits of all those candidates. But if you only had two judicial races on the ballot and you didn't have an easy crutch like a D or an R to go on, a voter who wanted to be informed could probably get informed. And if you weren't informed, you probably would skip that race. So I think there's a lot to be said for the initial election system. Inherently, I think appointed judges tend to avoid the very worst people at the bottom, but sometimes the most qualified person is not going to get that appointment either, because they are they might have sharp elbows or have made some enemies somewhere along the way.
To your point, they're really either way under the appointment system or the nonpartisan election system. There really isn't a way to take politics out of it entirely. So it's always going to be a factor under any system.
Right. And the U.S. Supreme, obviously, with an appointed judiciary, you're an appointing authority, be that a governor or a committee, they're going to want to appoint their friends more than their enemies. In an elected system, the U.S. Supreme Court has made quite clear that you cannot closely police what a candidate chooses to say. If a candidate chooses to say, you should vote for me because I will take off every afternoon and go down to the border and help Donald Trump build his wall, you can say that as a candidate. We had candidates who Trump's picture was a lot bigger than theirs on their campaign literature, for instance. And no doubt candidates who put Obama and Biden's picture bigger than theirs. I just didn't see those. But at any rate, because you can't police those statements, the only effective policing comes through recusal motions, which are perhaps not as easy to file, not as favored by parties and their lawyers as the Supreme Court justices imagined they are. That's a somewhat inadequate policing. So when you have an election, yes, politics is going to play a role, because somebody's going to think that will help them win.
Well, looping back again to the idea of this is a constitutional issue, and considering the split among the commission, and you mentioned the difficulties faced in the current legislative session, where this rather clearly isn't going to rise, I don't think, to the top of the priority list. It's worth pointing out that, if I remember correctly, you know, we are talking about a constitutional amendment to change this process, and the vote required for that, I believe, is two-thirds.
Two-thirds of each house of the legislature, and then a majority of the voters. We've had that two-thirds in one house or the other a number of times over the past 30 years. Never had it in both houses. And the closest we came was my last session as chief in 2003, passed the Senate with a somewhat watered-down plan, and we counted a majority in the House, but the ascendant political party at the time put pressure in the right places, and no hearing was held in the House of Representatives, so we didn't get a vote. There are things that can be done by a simple vote of both houses of the legislature and a signature of the governor, and that would include nonpartisan elections. It could include crossfire, which we only did in Texas once in 1952, but it's still been done, I think, in New York and maybe California, where in those states, people can file in multiple primaries. You could also require judicial candidates to file in every primary. Imagine in a day of YouTube, the salutary effect it would have on candidates if they appeared at a Democratic event and a Republican event in the same night. Their speeches might be more on what the judiciary is really about and not going to do for you as soon as I get into office. So anyway, I've always been a strong proponent of cross-filing, but if somebody listening would join in that pitch, we could double the support. We could also affect ballot access by majority vote, which of course has been done for the courts of appeals and the urban district courts with the signature process. Mm-hmm. And I think that signature process has been a huge boon to the Court of Criminal Appeals, particularly where you used to have open races would attract 7 or 8 candidates. And it was frequently who drew the best ballot positions in the largest counties determined who was going to be the nominee of a party for those races. And you've got to be a serious person to get 50 signatures in each of the 14 appellate districts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the signatures, I think it certainly keep last-minute candidates out of district court races in the urban areas. But you could look at certain levels of judicial education or attainment as a ballot access issue that might have some legal problems, but it might not. The signatures have never been challenged as a constitutional impediment to serving. They're just an impediment to getting the chance to serve.
I know with qualifications, you know, there is a constitutional dimension to judicial qualifications, but could the legislature tighten those without having to amend the Constitution?
Only through ballot access.
Mm-hmm.
But I must say, I think if any constitutional amendment would pass, it would be one that something like you have to have either been a judge of another court of record or appeared in a court with a client in the type of court that you want to serve in. I think that would pass, whereas a lot of emphasis is on longer terms, and that fails in every state it's been tried in. And now there is a constitutional amendment proposed in this legislature that would double the time. It would go up. You'd have to go to 8 years as a lawyer before you could run for district judge, which in the past, it's been a real inflection point for people. The 6th, 7th year of their practice is, particularly if you're at a larger firm, it's when you learn from people older and wiser than you that your talents might lie in an area where you don't have to be as aggressive or as much of an advocate, and you think, hey, that sounds like Judge. The list of people who've started at a relatively young age as a district judge in Texas and gone on to very prominent positions, like, say, two of the last three chief justices of the Supreme Court and a number of Fifth Circuit judges or judges on other federal benches and state appellate benches, is pretty long. I'm particularly offended by somebody saying, well, if we're just for lengthening the number of years you have to have held a law license without it being suspended, we have solved the problem. That offends me because I don't think that's our major problem.
I think there are some attorneys that become less qualified the longer they practice. So, you know, I'm not sure that that solves that.
Yeah, I think it's much too crude a metric to constitutionalize it. I am glad we have some years of practice. There are, in California, there have been people elected to the bench in their first year of practice. They probably haven't suffered enough on the other side of the bench to be ideal judges. And I'm not unalterably opposed. I mean, certainly I wouldn't be opposed to 6 years for a district judge, and maybe not 8, because the inflection point that I mentioned earlier is coming later and later now in practice. But I wouldn't want the age requirement to be so long that people are making so much money in practice that they don't want to give government service in the judiciary a try. A lot of people go at all stages of their career to serve in state or federal government for a short term. And, you know, you've saved up enough money that you go to be deputy general counsel of an agency for 2 years, and that helps your practice, et cetera. But generally, when we're asking somebody to be a judge, it's a much longer commitment. And if they've gotten used to the big bucks, but they're still rather young, I don't know how many of them we're going to get. The old model when I started practicing was 55, and you know, you had your kids were out of college, and you'd salted away some money, and you went and spent your last 10 or 12 years in the judiciary. I think that the increasing political demands have made people at that stage and place in their lives and careers somewhat less anxious to become a state judge. And likewise, in the federal judiciary, that's become such a high-stakes poker game that presidents increasingly want younger people who will stay longer, who will have longer. And so the model for when I started practicing law, is you capped off your career on either the state or the federal bench has changed rather dramatically. And I don't think we're going to be able to put it back in place with a constitutional amendment.
That's fascinating, really. So the commission, the Texas Commission on Judicial Selection, is it basically sunsetted with this current legislature, or does it extend beyond?
It was supposed to file a report by December 31st and wither away. But our report did offer to stay and do further study if the legislature wants that. And I've been watching my email. I haven't seen a request that we continue to study.
You know, I've reviewed the roster of that commission, and I believe former Chief Justice Jefferson is on it. There are a lot of other dignitaries who have the experience to speak on this issue, it seems to me. And it's a shame that it seems like all that effort would go for naught, but probably somewhat telling that the vote was so evenly divided in terms of, you know, what the recommended systems might be. But it sounds like there's hope for the future in terms of other ways of being able to deal with the things that we see as sort of the negatives about elected judges in Texas.
And some of it really comes down to the bar educating the public on judicial selection and judges and what the courts actually do, because I think a lot of voters just don't necessarily have the context, and it's become so easy to let a political party be sort of your deciding factor for a judicial election without any real thought to the consequences of that.
I'm sure the causes are multifarious, but the decline in civics education, and probably if we tried to have civics education, there would be such a political battle over what it taught, even in the judiciary. I digress but in 2008, a poll was done about a lot of questions about the Obama-McCain race, and one was judges. And nearly all the McCain voters thought that judges' job was to apply the laws that were passed by the popular branches of government, come what may. And nearly all the Obama voters thought a judge's job was to see that justice was done. That was the very name of their job, after all, and not to care too much about what some piece of paper said in the past. That split, you can multiply that really in a whole number of areas across history and civics, but the decline of civics has made it where I think it's news to a whole lot of people that many judges see themselves as having a fundamentally different role than other government officials. So you got that problem. And then I also mentioned the decline in local news. I mean, everything is nationalized now. And, well, it's frankly more exciting news than what your local school board is doing. It's going to attract a larger audience, you know, to watch Fox or MSNBC skewer somebody on a nightly basis. And that's where people are getting their news. So it just does not help them be informed when they go into that ballot booth, particularly in a large urban area, and see a mass of names that you have to sort through.
For courts that people don't really have any sense what they do, you know, I mean, I think there's very few people outside of the bar that could name the 9 justices on the Texas Supreme Court or really explain what that court does.
Well, even Ronald Reagan, who knew something about government, when he introduced me at the Mesquite Rodeo in 1988, said, in these immortal words, "Chief Justice Don Phillips has joined with Vice President Bush to lead the war on crime here in Texas."
I'm hearing those words in a Reagan voice right now.
It was stirring. I mean, I was touched, but I didn't want to be held responsible for any failures on the war on crime, if there were any, despite George and my giving our best shot on it.
Yeah, we usually ask for a war story, but that's a pretty darn good
one. Yeah, that's going to be a hard one to top, I have to say. Any behind the scenes stories you can tell?
I guess Abbott's story is we went to Waco. We started visiting around the state at law schools and now at other schools, because the Conference of Chief Justice said this was a good idea and it has been. And the court, generally the judges go and teach a high school class during the day, meet with the bar at night, and hold arguments the next morning. But anyway, we were in Waco and we went back to the makeshift conference room and we put on our robes and then we came back in and sat back down and we didn't all sit at the same seats. And I was sitting in Abbott's seat. And we got up to leave to go to lunch with the professors at Baylor, and I put on Abbott's coat, which the sleeves only came to about my elbow. And it seemed puzzling to me that I had grown that much in just 2 hours of argument. But I went on and started out the door, and Abbott came up and said, "Judge, you notice anything unusual about the way you look?" And so, well, I hadn't thought much about it. Well, look at your coat and look at mine. And he was down. Of course, the sleeves were past his hands. So I do remember that, but there are probably a lot better ones, but I'll just leave you with that.
I like that one. I think that's a good one to end on.
I do too.
Thank you so much. This has been such a great history and understanding of judicial selection in Texas, and we really appreciate you coming and sharing your perspective with us.
Well, I'm delighted to do it and glad you all are doing this. And for people who might be interested in this kind of thing, this is a good thing to be interested in.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.